there. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm so happy that you're tuning into this episode because I have a guest on. Her name is Mel. She's an integrative counselor and all around lovely person to hear talk and to listen to. I hit her with some really kind of tough questions on fat positivity, intersectionality, and her answers were really lovely. And I was listening back to the podcast to edit, I was in awe of her and her work, and I think this episode is just really, really lovely. I really wanted to record this episode because I think I needed a really lovely, juicy episode to give to you, and because I needed an episode to send to my clients who really struggle with living in their body and being in their body and trying to feel better about their body while also struggling with being in a larger body and what that means in this world. So I think this episode is a really lovely introduction to fat positivity, and I really hope that you enjoy. Any questions that you've got about the episode, you can email Mel or get in touch with her from her website, because I've got her website in the show notes, or you can email me or message me on Instagram as well. I really hope that you enjoy this episode. I think it's a really good one and I'm really proud of this work, so I hope that you enjoy, and let's get into it. Morning, Mel.
Good morning.
Hi, thanks for joining me. How are you?
Thanks for having me here. I'm really good, thanks. I've got my coffee and I'm ready for our chat today. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I've got my coffee too, but it's absolutely rubbish. I hate when that happens.
Oh no.
Yeah.
what's rubbish about it?
Just, you know what, it just like doesn't, it's not hitting, and it just doesn't taste good. Like it just doesn't have a lot of flavor, and I'm just like, ugh.
oh no, I'm sorry, yeah, to hear that. There's nothing worse than bad coffee. Coffee's important,
especially when it's your first one in the morning, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh.
I really like when I have guests on, it's for them to maybe tell us a bit about themselves, including like professional and personal, if you want to, like things you like to get up to when you're not working, anything interesting about you, anything like that. Do you want to share?
Yeah, sure. So I am an integrative counsellor. I mainly work with like disordered eating and body image stuff. I've worked for eating disorder charities probably for the last 7 years or so now in various different roles. I've always been really passionate about eating disorders, I think because of people that I knew, I went to school with, and also because I've had a complex relationship with food myself, though I would never have really even thought that before. I didn't even realize there was a lot of things that I thought were normal that I've had to kind of reframe and go, oh, that's not normal. And I think that led me more into like disordered eating as opposed to eating disorders, because then it sort of covers a lot of people who wouldn't necessarily get a diagnosis like myself, but have really, really struggled with eating and with body image as well. I work in private practice as a counsellor, mainly doing my sessions online. I offer workshops as well in various places at various times. And a lot of the time that attracts counsellors to it, but I try and kind of make those open to anyone as well. And I have done some body acceptance workshops with my mum, which has been sweet, which have been quite good. So yeah, I'm currently thinking about what I do with those and where I go with those next year, but there'll be something coming up. In my job, I work 3 days a week, and I work with perpetrators of domestic abuse. So I'm a behaviour change advisor, probably just as passionate about that as all the eating disorder stuff, to be honest. I really find so much passion in working with both, especially group work with men, because I think it's very powerful for some men who've never had chance to talk about emotions in that space. So it's been an incredible journey, probably for the last kind of 7 years, I'd say, learning more about eating disorders, my counselling training, and learning so much more about domestic abuse and coercive control. So my life is mainly work, to be honest, because I'm very passionate about what I do. So outside of that, I often think, well, what else do I do apart from watching some trash TV? I do like cold water swimming as well. I'm one of those people, though I am actually rubbish at swimming. I'm more of like a dipper and a little bit of a ponder around and then get out and eat cake sort of person. But yeah, so that's about me.
Oh, I love that. What a nice overview. Okay, so you've been in this space, I guess, for like 7 years-ish. But it sounds like before that you were involved in other ways, like maybe with your own relationship to food, and then it's kind of blossomed into your career. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my experiences as a child have really shaped the things that I've gone into, to be honest. And through that, I've had a lot of my own personal therapy as well. I mean, you need to when you train to be a counsellor, but I'd a lot of my own stuff to work through. So yeah, I think it's very much lived experience on the basis of food and domestic abuse, witnessing domestic abuse as a child, and also body image stuff as well. And it really shapes what I do now. Also, I think there's a lot of anxiety and things when I was a child that I didn't even know was called anxiety at the time. A lot of feeling like I didn't fit in and I didn't belong, and a lot of this has really shaped me, especially in terms of social justice as well, and inclusion, belonging, diversity, I guess they call it, but looking at things through an intersectional lens and learning about myself and where I fit, and thinking about class as well. So it's really yes, I've had a lot to learn, and I'm sure that I still do. I mean, I think that's why I became a counsellor, because it's constant learning and personal growth, which I think is great. I really enjoy it.
Thanks for sharing with us. I've got loads of questions based off what you just said. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
My brain is pinging. It's like, oh, let me ask about this and this and this. So let me start with okay, you said this nice word that I really love, intersectional. Can you tell us what that means and how it fits into this like broader, this is a disordered eating podcast. So let's say how it fits into this space and like healing from disordered eating. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my way of thinking about it really is also through a weight stigma lens and through a fat phobia lens, and how that intersects with different forms of identity. So I think intersectionality comes from somebody called Kimberly Crenshaw, I think her name was. I don't know if I'm saying a surname right, but there's a body of stuff that people can go and look up on her work and other people's work based on intersectionality. And it's about how different forms of identity intersect, really connect to each other, and how that forms the basis of who you are and how you live in the world and various privileges that you may have. I think it's all on a big sort of spectrum and is not black and white or linear at all. It's very complex. And I think it can be really difficult for people to sort of get their heads around as well, because it isn't a case of you've got privilege and you haven't. There's a whole lot more to it than that, because when you think it brings in class, gender, sexuality, ability, disability, there's a whole load. I can't list them all here because there's probably too many. It's your level of education, it's your appearance, as well, body size. Often body size kind of is left out a little bit of this. And
Yes.
that's why I like to, when I do my trainings, kind of bring body size into that in connection with all those things, because how people feel about their bodies is also going to be tied into how they feel about their gender presentation, for example, for how maybe they've been taught to think about food and bodies when they're from a working class background. If they've grown up around food scarcity or food insecurity, there's a, you know, there's so many people that need to use food banks now, and thinking about how that will affect someone's relationship with food when they're older as well. If I can just share a bit of something personal here. There's, when I was at school in the 80s, there was we had these little tokens, I think, for free school dinners. And there was a sense of feeling different and singled out and a bit in the spotlight there, and people sort of questioning and wondering why I had something different and why I had school dinners, because I was from a single parent family. So I could do that. But I think kids don't really understand that. You're just seen as different then. And it felt quite shameful. I think that can start off a sort of shameful thing. Obviously, it's probably one of the things in many, but one thing that can maybe spark a little bit of shame around food, feeling different, feeling maybe like, why do I get this when others don't? People are questioning me about my family and things as well. So that's maybe just my experience of it, but I'm aware that for a lot of people, things like class and narratives around food as well, narratives at the dinner table, your parents' relationships with food, and all of this ties into the way that you grew up and your culture as well. There's so much in it, so I don't want to ramble on too long.
Well, I think that was a really nice overview, and you're so right. When I first heard about intersectionality, I don't know, probably like 6 or 7 years ago now, I was like, okay, cool, yeah, I get it. And I kind of understood it on the surface level. But actually, it's only been in the last 2 or 2 years-ish that I've really like understood it properly. And I'm actually going to share one of the ways that I kind of learned about it more, like kind of really understood it more. And it sounds quite simple, but I'll share, because actually I think it could be helpful. So I read this book called We Need to Talk About Money. And it was a book, I actually can't remember the person that wrote it, but it was a book about money and relationships to money. And obviously this also fed into gender, class, education, race, all of this stuff. And one of like the paragraphs that she wrote in the book was, okay, so this was written by a Black woman. She's like, well, someone who holds different privileges to me, even if we're both, let's say, like highly educated, they both went to private school, they both had like a lot of, expendable income. But the fact that I'm a Black woman in this world is very different to my peers' experiences of white women. And then she kind of explained it more. And it's kind of like this layering effect that's like, you can be like a 10 out of 10 privilege with, let's say, like you can be a white male in this world who's able-bodied, highly educated, et cetera, et cetera. But even just one, let's say, we call them like social graces, right? Like all of the kind of intersectionalities, even just one of them being the not, let's say, preferred, really like changes the dynamics actually with how you live with all those intersectionalities. So yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but that's like something that I've really brought to my work in the last couple of years, because, well, I, you know, speak about this on the podcast a lot. Like, obviously I'm, you know, white, grew up pretty middle class. But I grew up in like a place that was quite lower class. So I was middle class in like a lower class place, which was kind of confusing. And so my privilege as like a middle class person is reflected on the fact that I grew up in a lower class place. So like even just the fact that I'm middle class is different to someone else who grew up middle class, which is like still a big privilege. But I just think it's fascinating how all of our stuff comes together, if that makes sense.
I think it's it's only been more recently that I've really started to think about and understand it as well, as I say, mainly through like learning more about fat acceptance and body acceptance. And that was my kind of I think through my training, actually, for a while I was looking at white privilege, and I did a very good course around that as well, actually. So it was from a few different angles. I suppose for me, I'll be honest and say, like, I think that privilege is a sticky word. I think it might be for some working class people, especially because when someone tells someone who doesn't feel privileged that they're privileged, it often doesn't stick well. It doesn't go well. I think this is what we see online with like arguments and things breaking out on stuff, because the word privilege is difficult for people. And I've come to understand that it means, you know, if you privilege because, for instance, I'm privileged because I've got white skin, that's different to the sort of privilege that I maybe would have considered when I heard that word before. So before, I might have thought privilege meant growing up with money. So I've just had to kind of shift my what that word means, really. It's a different meaning in this context. And I think, oh yes, I do. I've never had to go through the world affected by anything because of my skin color, so I understand it in that way now. But yeah, I can see why the word privilege is really a prickly one, I would say, for many people.
Yeah, it is prickly, and you're so right, because this might be a little bit weird, but there was, I don't know if you know the TV show Superstore.
No.
Okay, so it's like a shop that's kind of like a Walmart vibe, and there was like an episode, it's like a sitcom, and there was an episode about how it was like gender equality and how men are more privileged than women. And the men in the shop, the men like working in the shop in the show, were like, oh, well, like, I'm not privileged because like I work here and like I've, you know, I'm like working class, etc. And it was actually really interesting because that is intersectionality. So it was mostly like white men. These white men who are told, oh, you're privileged, you're like living in this world and you have more rights and freedom than women. But actually, in their intersectional identities, they are very working class. Most of them, you know, are going to be like in that job forever. Like, and that's like where their intersectionality came in. And it was just like a TV show, but I thought, oh, like, I've like realized something just from this episode. Because it's not as simple as you have privilege or you don't, right? Mm-hmm. And like, things all come together in like a little jumbled little box, right?
I think a lot of the men that I work with through my work, the perpetrator work and things, would find it very difficult to see their privilege, really. There's many of them have had really difficult lives, potentially some of them having been to prison, many of them being really traumatized. And I just think, you know, having certain privileges in terms of identity doesn't take away the trauma that people have been through, or the hurt that they've been in, or their need for therapy or anything else like that. Still, just as valid. But I think it's the context stuff, isn't it? This is why for me, counselling is really important to see through a social justice and an intersectional context, because there's often questions in the therapy community about, oh, it should it be political? And it's not that politics necessarily comes into the room or talked about. It's not necessarily even really talked about unless your clients want to talk about. when I was a client, I was in therapy for a long time, I probably did talk about this stuff a lot, but it's not necessarily even talked about. But it's having that awareness of the context of it, and I think that's also bringing it back to like body image and body, like fat acceptance and fat positivity and things. That's where also the context of understanding some things about weight stigma and fat phobia and how that fits within this is really helpful as well, so that as professionals, not just therapists, nutritionists, like fitness professionals, all sorts of people working with people in larger bodies, don't cause any more harm than they might have already experienced in the world, because they will likely have already experienced stigma because of their appearance or body size.
Yeah, and I wonder, I want to say, like, I guess for me, one of the ways I came into intersectionality and knowing about it was actually through like a weight stigma lens, because, you know, I was working in disordered eating and that was kind of my intro into this space, which I think is really common for like nutritionists, dietitians, because we come into it from, I mean, mostly like very privileged people. And so we come into it from like the body lens and the weight stigma lens. And so that's kind of how I came into this space. So I wonder, would you be able to tell us, and I know it's like a big thing, but what weight stigma is and how that fits into people's identities?
For me, weight stigma, I would think about as a discrimination, really, although technically it isn't one of the protective factors that can be discriminated against. So it can be a form of discrimination, I guess, stigma. It can be shaming, it can be body shaming, it can be judgments and biases. Some of those might be unconscious biases. So I think there's very probably explicit things and implicit things as well. So probably the explicit comments about people's weights, but then there's the sort of undercurrent of the implicit thing, which I would link to sort of diet culture kind of thinking. The kind of underlying, it's not always said, well, it is said actually, but it not doesn't necessarily need to be said, but thin is the ideal. That's the kind of, you know, the undercurrent of, we've had decades of seeing thin people on TV, thin people is the way to go. Attractiveness means thin, white and young, and all the messages that we're getting in any way, which let's face it, film, TV, social media, it's a lot of messages telling us what we should be and what we should look like. So I think that, and sadly some of our government policies as well, actually increases weight stigma, because the more that we sort of fight against people being fat, the more shame that brings to people, and the more fear that brings to people who, it's the fact people who aren't fat as well, because it reinforces that fear of getting fat. And of course then things like this is what will encourage disordered eating and may result in eating disorders.
So true. And I wonder, now this is a bit of a tricky topic for me because I've not really been able to find a definitive answer for it, but what do you think about the idea that eating disorders are fat phobic, and like eating disorders make people fat phobic? And I have seen a lot of stuff from people with eating disorders kind of really pushing against this and being really cross that this has ever been said. So I don't know, have you like heard this, and can you speak to this a little bit? What do you think?
I'm glad that you asked that. I'm going to answer this just from my perspective of something that is current for me. I actually tweeted about this the other day, because I've been doing a CBTE course, which is the transdiagnostic adapted form of cognitive behavioral therapy. It's made for eating disorders. It's seen as like, it's the research one, it's the gold standard, it's seen as the best thing to treat eating disorders, often used in the NHS. I don't work in the NHS and I'm not a CBT therapist, so I'll be honest that I went into it in quite a skeptical mind also, because I had an idea that it would be quite fat phobic. So I think some of the systems around eating disorders that treat eating disorders and the research and everything on a systemic level, I do think there is weight stigma and fat phobia running through the system. However, that system actually still helps people, but it's actually designed for a certain group of people. So I find that the CBTE a lot of the things that they might use, in my view, are designed for thin people. I think because most of the people in treatment do have restrictive eating disorders. And so it is mainly probably going to be anorexia with people at very low weights. However, generally from other research, we know that most people with eating disorders are at higher weights. And actually anorexia is probably one of the least prevalent eating disorders, but it's probably the most dangerous because it has a high mortality rate. So I think the treatment is all set up to treat a very specific group of thin people who are mainly female. So for some people in those groups, they might find that that treatment has been really helpful for them. So, and when it's research, it shows to be helpful because it's helpful for that small group of people. But in the grand scheme of things, it's a tiny group of people. And I believe that if we really want to help eating disorders and people with eating distress in general, there needs to be a much, much wider lens. And that ties into weight stigma because it is weight stigma that stops that from happening. So, for instance, the myths around you need to be thin to have an eating disorder, the fact that there is weight stigma and biases in medical professionals as well. Like they're just human, they've grown up in the same world as us, so you know they don't have very much training on eating disorders as well. So there's a sense that people in larger bodies actually might just need to go on a diet, or they might need to be sent to a weight management service. It may not be picked up on that they have an eating disorder. So for me, there's a whole, it's the system that is sort of with that weight stigma and fat phobia that is impacting who gets treatment. And the actual, and the treatment, so people in treatment may, you know, may find it helpful for, but for me, it's more who's being left out is really important for me, and preventative methods, because that is seen as the most important thing in the NICE guidelines, that we need to be preventing eating disorders. And we are massively failing at that at the moment.
Yeah, hear, hear. I co-sign everything you just said. Also, I was just thinking, you know, we talk about restrictive eating disorders, and, you know, I know maybe for the listeners, maybe they view that as like someone in a small body who's eaten very little food. But, you know, fat people have restrictive eating disorders. And also there's a bias for fat people to be, let's not say diagnosed, because clinical psychologists, like, you know, do a whole assessment on people, but let's say diagnosed in the kind of colloquial like sense, like there's a bias for diagnosis in people in big, larger bodies to be diagnosed with binge eating disorder, when actually they might be struggling with anorexia or bulimia, right? That's something that I've seen many times in my clinic. And it, you know, I mean, I'm in private practice, so if people come to me and they say, oh, I have this diagnosis, like it doesn't really matter too much because we work on whatever they need. But in a more traditional setting like NHS, that does dictate the treatment that they get and the support that they're having. So yeah, I just wanted to name that too. Do you find that there's a kind of thing about, there's something in here about restrictive eating disorders and disordered eating only being applied to people in small bodies? When actually restriction is really like often the roots of something like binge eating disorder, right?
Yeah, I was going to say that. It can come into the part of binge eating, can't it? Because sometimes binging can be because of restriction. For instance, I see, you know, quite a lot of people say they binge in the evening, and it's because maybe they've, not just because, but because they've maybe been restricting in the day. So yeah, restrictions usually is often part of it. It's very much based on, again, weight stigma and assumptions about fat and thin people. And absolutely people can have restrictive eating disorders or eating problems when they're in larger bodies. And also people can binge eat when they're in smaller bodies as well, because just because they binge eat doesn't mean it's fat, they're fat. It doesn't mean them you know, it's either way. It works either way. I think anyone of any body size can have any eating disorder. But it's interesting how it's also separated out in labels as well, because there's atypical anorexia. And atypical anorexia is someone who's not at a low body weight, but actually it's just anorexia. It's actually just the same. You can still be malnutritioned, can't you, even if you're not underweight. So I think the separating out of that is also maybe there's some weight stigma in there as well of why do we need to label this differently? I'm thinking that means that they're not going to be seen as a priority for treatment or help because they're not there yet. And then when you wait for people to be very, very underweight or very unwell, it's a firefighting system effectively, mm-hmm. which is what we're kind of stuck in now. And it's underfunded and there's not enough, there's never enough money or people, is there? But especially in eating disorders, it's really just waiting for people to get very, very sick until they're treated. And it's a really, it feels like a really broken system. And it's very infuriating and really sad for that reason.
Yeah, it's all of those things and it just sucks.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, can I say another thing on that as well? Sorry, I was just going to say about sometimes what I see is people saying that obesity, I'm going to say, I'm sorry for the O word, it's stigmatizing for some people. So I may just say the O word from now on, but I felt like I needed to say it to know what it is, people to know what it is. It's quite a stigmatizing word sometimes for people in larger bodies. I mean, everyone likes to use the words that they use to describe themselves. It might be larger body, it might be fat. They can call themselves the O word if they want to, but because a lot of assumptions and stigma has come from being labeled as the O word, then that's I think why there's a kind of move away in some communities from using it. But I just wanted to highlight, I have seen quite a few people think that the O word is opposite to anorexia, or lump that in with kind of an eating disorder. So I just like to say that obesity is definitely not an eating disorder. It is positioned as a disease sometimes. I don't think it's a disease. I think it's just a body size measure based off a BMI chart that is outdated and rubbish. and there's huge variation in these categories above the healthy, I'm doing air quotes, healthy weight of BMI, of varying degrees of health in people, as there is within for thin people as well. So it's, we can never make any judgments based on being fat or thin, but I think that it's important that people don't just equate obesity with they must have a binge eating disorder, they must not have a very good relationship with food, there must be a problem, because there might not be a problem, they might just be fat, and they might be absolutely fine with being fat. And it's more weight stigma is more it's other people's problems. I think for a lot of fat people, they're actually just trying to escape weight stigma. It's probably not even the fact that they've got a larger body, it's the fact that living with weight stigma and being judged by people and living in that world is really hard. So it's completely understandable that they want to get away from that. I always say that I'm kind of anti-diet and kind of fat positive, and in the way that in a societal wider view, but on an individual basis, when clients come to me, I can understand why people desperately want to lose weight, why they go on diets, why they have weight loss surgeries and things, because we live in a world that makes it quite terrifying for some people to be fat. I've literally seen people who are being told that they're going to die because they're fat, and this level of fear and shame, sadly, what it does is it reinforces the disordered eating. It just makes them double down on it. So it's not working at all. Shame is just not a motivator at all for help. I think what would be the motivator would actually be learning to understand and respect and accept your own body, because that is a lot more kind and compassionate towards yourself than all the shame and the stigma that's been placed on you.
Oh, thank you so much for saying this. I'm just thinking about people who are listening who are probably thinking, oh my gosh, I needed to hear that. Thank you, because and I often see professionals, it's often dietitians and nutritionists, they'll kind of say, oh, I'm a eating disorder and O word specialist. And it's absolutely bananas to me because I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, people who are so-called people, all word, right? They can have an eating disorder or they cannot, right? Like, but it's nothing to do with their body size. And that's one thing that drives me absolutely bananas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's almost like a completely conflicting thing. So if you say you're treating the O word, what you're doing is actually reinforcing the weight stigma that keeps the disordered eating going potentially. So you could just be in the cycle of yeah. increasing that with people and not actually helping. I don't think that it's fatness is not something to be treated or sort out or fix or make go away. I think that a lot of people really struggle with their relationships with food. So that's probably, you know, where the work is of people like us, of understanding that and understanding things in their past and understand and kind of building their self-worth, I guess. But for me as a therapist, it's actually like probably less about the foods and more the way that they think about it, the way that they've been taught, the narratives they picked up, the things that have happened in the past to mean that maybe they're using something like food as a coping mechanism. So people, when they come to me, will often be surprised at how little we talk about food, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, with sometimes I do talk about it quite a lot, but it depends on what they're looking for in the presentation. I'm quite adaptable in the way that I work as well, but I do find people go, we haven't talked about food very much, have we? And I'll go, okay, let's talk about food. And then within 10 minutes we're already back on to something else, something in childhood, something relational, because these for me are more of the roots of the roots of it all that is really important to explore.
Yeah, exactly. That's so true. That's so true. Well, I'm conscious of time.
Mm-hmm.
I really loved chatting with you about this. I think this has been an absolute excellent episode for everyone. I wonder if you can mention or just talk about fat positivity and how that can be like a really lovely way to heal your relationship to food and your body. And I'm giving you a lot here. And just like, how can people maybe work towards being a bit more neutral of their body or positive towards their body if they want to, and especially speaking to those people in larger bodies. So do with that what you can. Good luck.
Yeah, I could honestly talk about this all day, but yeah, succinctly, I think on this I will talk from my own experience again, because I just want to level with people and go, I know how hard it is when you start thinking about body positivity or a body acceptance or whatever the words are that you want to use about that, is that it's such a big jump that I've had it myself to be like, oh great, so I'll just spend like decades hating my body and then suddenly love it. Like, it's not going to work. I'm more about being realistic about this. I think this is maybe where the neutrality bit comes into it, or just working towards acceptance, or it just being okay wherever you're at, because sometimes the roots of it are so deep. And if you think, if you've hated your body for maybe 30 years, how that actually, and this may not be a great thing to hear actually, but it might take quite a few years as well to start on doing that. It's going to take a really long time, but once you sort of are on the right path with it, it's just a learning thing that will just continue and will just bloom and will just open out. So my own experiences of it are that yes, it's really tough, and that honoring where you're at and having compassion for yourself is probably the best way to go with it. And also practical stuff like looking at what you're looking at on social media as well, and thinking about how that's impacting you, and if it's helpful, and who you're following, and if you want to follow more people in larger bodies who talk about this stuff, and surrounding yourself with that kind of media, and reading and learning more about this as well from people who've also been on their own journeys. Mm. I think at this point I'll just mention Aubrey Gordon as one of my favorite people. Aubrey Gordon has a podcast called Maintenance Phase, which is really good. She's like, they are so good at researching things, her and her co-hosts. They research it so well.
But yeah, they're so good at it.
Yeah, they're really good, aren't they? It feels like they put so much work into each episode because there's so much research, but it's also presented in like quite a funny way as well. And Aubrey Gordon has two books, and she's written blogs she has a blog. She used to blog as Your Fat Friend, and she has a really good one on BMI. So earlier on when I said BMI is rubbish, if you want to know more about that, then Aubrey Gordon's article, I think it's on Medium and on her blog, is about it's a really long article breaking down the roots of the BMI and why it's so problematic. So I think if there's anyone that I was going to mention, like Aubrey Gordon, there's various other people. Chrissy Harrison has a podcast and a book, I think just called Anti-Diet, her book is called. That's good as well. For more I guess I don't want to call it like entry level, easier reads, like first sort of read, Meg and Jane Crabb's book on body positivity is a good sort of entry level. And she also does this thing where she sections out parts for if it might be triggering for those who've had an eating disorder or are struggling with food as well. So I found that's helpful. And she's a very positive person to follow online as well. She used to be called Body Potty Panda, but Megan Jane Crabb is what she goes by now. So she's quite a general positive person for your Instagram feed, I'd say. Just going through thinking more about in terms of other more practical like tips and things that I did that helped me as well. So counselling. This is not only a kind of plug for myself, obviously I'm a counsellor, but also I had a hell of a lot of therapy, and a lot of things to do with body image and food were to do with shame and self-worth and self-esteem. And some of that is deeper rooted. So as much as CBT and has its place, I think there's a need for a very relational approach, considering attachment and other stuff in childhood as well, a person-centered approach. I mean, I'm integrative, but all of these things just mean meeting a person where they're at and really helping sort of explore those things about self-worth and having that really relational, trusting aspect to it. And that for me came with quite long-term therapy. So it was quite long-term, deeper healing, as well as those practical levels of reading and learning about stuff. Also, like with that, I think comes building some boundaries as well, and choosing the people that you have around you, choosing the friends and the people that you have. You can't always choose your family or your co-workers, but being able to put in boundaries as well. I think if you build your confidence and self-worth a bit, it will help you to be able to maintain boundaries with people who, for instance, may talk about dieting in the workplace. And it'll help you either be able to put in a boundary, perhaps even talk to them about it, or actually just remove yourself from it if you don't feel like you can tackle it. So we don't always have to be doing the work. Like sometimes it's just we need to keep ourselves sort of safe from it. A lot of it is building compassion, I find, which I will be honest, I'm still working on all the time. Part of being a counsellor is also looking after myself and self-care. So it's become even more important now I'm a therapist to do that, and finding ways of being able to maybe if you're interested in exercise or you like movement or something, finding something that is yours that doesn't feel like a punishment. I was used to feel like exercise was punishment. Now I go on these wild swim groups, and everybody's just like, no one talks about bodies, like no one cares, everyone's just different sizes, everyone's old and young and like fat and thin, and no one at all cares about it, and we all just eat cake afterwards. And like that is the kind of space that I want to be in if I'm going to be doing like it's kind of movement or exercise. So yeah, that was quite— Do you think I covered everything?
I think you did. Thank you for those. Yeah, you're so right. It's about I call it like the leaves and then the roots, right? Like you want to kind of go with surface level is a judgy thing, but the surface level stuff, it's like who you're following, what you're doing day to day, and then the roots, that's the tough stuff, right? Like the roots of how all of this came to be with how you feel about your body and things. So you're so right.
I love that, the leaves and the roots. Yes. I'm gonna steal that. I'm gonna use that. That's okay. I love that.
I love it. I think it's such a good analogy. And also because the roots feed the leaves, right, with like nutrients to help them grow. So I love it. I think it's gorgeous. I have a final question before we wrap up. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So do you think that you need to quit dieting and restricting and trying to change your body for you to gain a better relationship to your body? Because this is like the crux of my clients and, you know, people, the distress of not changing your body when you're in a larger body is so difficult, but they still want a good relationship to their body and they want to keep dieting and restricting and trying to change it, you know? So what do you think about this?
That's a very challenging question when we've got very little time left. Thank you for that. That's really difficult, isn't it? Because I think even if people want to completely let go of dieting and all of that, realistically, can that happen for some people? Maybe not. Maybe it's just been there too long. And actually, the pressure of that in and of itself might be unhelpful. I think sometimes the pressure to be body positive can actually then make people feel worse about themselves and add another layer onto it. And feeling shame about being ashamed, like, as well, like, I know that I shouldn't care about my body, I should be body positive, I should be a feminist, like, this is what I hear people saying, getting annoyed with themselves for not being able to do that. So I think it's just you're at where you're at in the broader grand scheme of things, then I think that some healing will come with gradually letting go of some, you know, diet things and focus on food and weight. But I don't think you can hurry that. So some freedom will come through it. It might not go completely, but you may learn better ways to manage, or ways to be happier or more about yourself. It's a long journey. It's always continuing. So I don't know if that's just a bit of a vague answer. I think it's so different for so many different people, because the circumstances around this are so different. But I think I'd like to just leave it letting people know that it's okay, wherever you're at. Mm-hmm. And that if we can just take like baby steps towards just feeling better about yourself in any way that works for you, having therapy or reading, maybe you don't feel ready for counseling yet, but maybe you do it in a different way. Whatever's right for you, those baby steps will still make a difference.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. Yeah, thank you for that. Well, to round up, why don't you share something that maybe the listeners can keep in your world with? So maybe your Instagram, your workshop, your email list. Is there anything you want to take them?
So mostly you can find everything from my website, which is melchavuco.com. And my surname is a little bit tricky to spell, but once you've seen it, I guess you'll see it on here, so you'll be able to just Google it. My surname makes me quite Googleable, so I'm sure you could probably find me. And then I'm also on Instagram and Twitter and things, which is not called Twitter anymore, sorry. So you can find me there. And on my website, I have a blog page on there where I have written about a number of these topics before. And I've also got a workshop page in there, which I'll update with more workshops that I'm going to be doing probably from next year. And I have a mailing list signed up on there as well.
All right, amazing. And obviously, for the listeners, Mel's website will be in the show notes, so you can just click on it and you'll be able to get all those bits and bobs.
Thank you
for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. It's been an amazing conversation. I feel like we could have talked about this all day.
Yeah, I agree. Well, thanks everyone for listening, and thanks to Mel for coming on, and I'll see you all next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you.